Hello, this is David Hopping with the News Gazette, dated June 20th, 2017. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Second Tax Suit Tallies $10 million, by Deborah Pressey. Another hospital tax exemption lawsuit that's been quietly looming over Champaign County taxing districts, while the more prominent Carl case has held center stage, has returned to the courtroom for the first time in 2 years, and there are millions of dollars at stake for both sides. In a lawsuit that was first filed in April 2015 and then put on hold 5 months later, Presence Covenant Medical Center is seeking a refund of $10 million in taxes it paid on dozens of properties plus interest for several tax years from 2003 through 2012, for which it didn't have tax exemptions. This is a lawsuit to kind of fill in the blank, said Covenant's lawyer, Stephen Flom. If exemptions on properties for certain tax years are blanks, there are a lot of them Covenant wants to fill in. There are 68 properties at issue, 58 in Urbana and 10 in Champaign. According to the original lawsuit that was stayed to give the Carl property tax exemption lawsuit time to work its way through the courts. The Carl Health System's long-standing lawsuit with local and state taxing authorities went to the Supreme Court in March and is now back in the Circuit Court. At stake in the present Covenant case is the hospital's belief that it is entitled to charitable tax exemptions for all the years it hasn't had them over about a decade. Champaign County Treasurer Dan Welch said tax years 2003, 2005, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2011, and 2012 remain in question, along with some properties for 2004 and 2006. His calculation on the interest local governments could owe as of May 1st, should Covenant Medical Center prevail in this action, is just over $1.5 million. If Judge Jeff Ford ordered a refund to be made on a certificate of error basis, that's a document used by taxing authorities to correct an error on a tax bill. Flom contended interest has been accruing at $500,000 a year on Covenant's back property taxes. Of all the taxing districts with the biggest liability if Covenant wins the lawsuit, the Urbana School District would owe the largest chunk of the refund, or $5.4 million, not including interest, according to Welch. In a status hearing Monday, Ford granted Assistant State's Attorney Joel Fletcher some extra time, a month, to rewrite a motion to dismiss the lawsuit and confer with his current clients. The defendants include Welch, the County Board of Review, its individual members, and the County Supervisor of Assessments. But since the original suit was filed, the Supervisor of Assessments and the two of the three board members of the Board of Review have changed. I'll continue with the front page article, Devastating to Everyone, Town Reeling After 14-Year-Old Autistic Boy Killed by Train, by Marcus Jackson. Soon after noon Monday, traffic lined the north and south streets of Macon Street, patiently waiting as a freight train barreled through Bement. For Connie Gudgel, who was out for a bike ride with friend Carolyn Trott, it was a heartbreaking reminder of what happened less than 24 hours earlier in the Piatt County village of 1700. On Sunday, 14-year-old Logan McKibben, whom Gudgel used to babysit as a small child, was struck and killed by a train while riding his bike on those same tracks. "It's just so heartbreaking," said Gudgel, a mother of three and grandmother of 13, her voice breaking with emotion. "The whole town is saddened. My heart goes out to his mother. I couldn't even imagine being in her shoes right now. This could have been any one of our kids. He lived just three blocks away from me." Logan, who had autism, was a student at Bement Middle School who was active in the Challenger League and Special Olympics. His mom, Cheryl McKibben, is a librarian in the Bement School District. Bement Superintendent Sheila Greenwood said grief counselors were at the school Monday to help comfort kids and adults alike. "It's a tragedy because he's a young man, and his mother is an employee here at the school. She's part of our school family, she and her son," Greenwood said. "You've got the rallying around of the school family plus the community. It's a very tight-knit group, and it's devastating to everyone involved because it's the loss of a young life. There are some, like Gudgel and Trott, who believe the tragedy involving Logan could have been prevented. The case remains under investigation," authorities said. "The crossing gates should also come down on the walkways," Gudgel said. "It's very unacceptable," Trott said. Bement Village President Pat Tyman was born and raised in the village and said utilizing crossing gates at the walkways is an idea he and the village will explore. For years, he has seen kids in middle school and high school crossing the tracks as trains approach. "I used to cross those tracks myself when I was a kid," he said. "The school had seminars in the gym about it. We've had the police here talking to the kids about it and trying to let them know it's not a good idea to do. Ultimately, if kids want to get around it, they're going to get around it." Timon said 34 trains come through Bement every day. "The incident involving Logan was by no means a case of a kid acting in a reckless manner," he said, "just an unfortunate accident." Timon and others in the community are working together to orchestrate a memorial for Logan. Trot, a Zumba instructor, is floating the idea of doing something connected with that to raise money for Logan's family. "We need to do something and come together as a community for this family," she said. The school district has set up an account where anyone can make donations to help the family. "I just spoke to his mother, and we're going to plan a prayer vigil for him and a balloon release," Timon said. "We're just trying to give the family time to heal and wrap their minds around what happened. Logan was such a great kid. He was a very important part of our community." I will continue with In the Wake of Shooting, Reps Hope for Bipartisanship by Tom Kasich. While U.S. Rep. Rodney Davis said he hopes last week's shooting at the Republican baseball team's practice leads to less hostility and more bipartisan cooperation in Congress, his political mentor said that any effect probably will be short-lived. Both Davis and his one-time boss, U.S. Rep. John Shimkus, R. Collinsville, were in East Central Illinois on Monday before heading back to Washington for another congressional work week. Each of the Republican congressmen was touched by last Wednesday's shooting at a GOP team practice at a public park in Alexandria, Virginia. Shimkus is a roommate of Rep. Steve Scalise, R. Louisiana, who was seriously injured in the shooting. Davis was at the practice during the incident, although he was not hurt. The gunman, James Hodgson of Belleville, a known opponent of Republican politics and President Trump in particular, was killed in the gunfight. "We've got to learn how to solve our policy differences through public debate like we heard today on ag issues and farm bill issues and solve them at the ballot box if you can't solve them in the legislative process," Davis said following a farm bill discussion Monday morning at the Bonneville farm of Paul and Shirley Burbaum. "Don't solve them by bringing a gun to a park in Alexandria, Virginia and trying to indiscriminately kill innocent people. We've got to take a step back and talk about what is important. To me, what's important is how we actually govern. How can we actually come together and work to get things done? There's always going to be fringes on both sides of the political spectrum, but the majority of Americans want us to work together. The majority of Americans are going to have to be the ones to stand up to the hateful rhetoric and stand up to this polarization." But Shimkus said he thought any impact probably would be fleeting. "I think that heated rhetoric will calm down for a while. I don't think there will be any appetite," he said after a short visit Monday afternoon to the Oakwood Public Library. "I think even members of Congress get carried away. I've gotten carried away before because we're emotional. We're type A individuals. We believe. I was a high school wrestler, right? We're kind of wrestling with ideas. We're competitive by nature. Now, if this helps us move some public policy forward, that's beneficial. If it keeps us in perspective that we're all human beings, that's helpful. Will this stop us from being mean and screaming and hollering? No, that's all part of human nature, so that will continue. But hopefully it will take a little while before we go back into the trenches." Davis expressed hope that a bipartisan spark would help Congress work on legislation, in particular an infrastructure improvement bill. "We have roads and bridges that are crumbling, and we ought to be able to come together as Democrats and Republicans to put a bill together that's going to pass," Davis said. "I was concerned a few weeks ago that we wouldn't be able to do that because there are some in Washington who wouldn't want to give President Trump a win. This is less now about President Trump getting a win and more about the American people getting a win." He said his message to the congressional colleagues who were concerned about his safety last week is, "Let's take this moment to find the areas where we can find the most agreement with the least amount of partisanship, and infrastructure should be the number one issue." Davis acknowledged, though, that there isn't even an infrastructure bill for Congress to consider. "There's no bill, but that's our job, to legislate," he said. "This week is a telltale sign to determine whether or not Washington is going to learn a lesson to tone down this hateful rhetoric, to tone down the polarization, or if Washington is going to continue down the path that let this madman to turn politics into his religion and try to indiscriminately kill all of us that morning in Alexandria." Shimkus said, however, that infrastructure is always bipartisan. It's roads and bridges. The question is, how do you get there, and how big? He said he thinks progress already is being made on a congressionally written infrastructure bill. Shimkus chairs the Environment Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Things are moving in our subcommittee, he said of bipartisan voice votes last week on provisions affecting nuclear waste and so-called highly polluted brownfields. We're trying to do a compromise, he said. I'll continue with the article entitled Satirist Man Sentenced to 20 Years for Molesting Child by Jessica Burstinsky and Mary Schenck. A satirist man found to have sexually molested a child under 13 was sentenced Monday to 20 years in prison. Joseph C. Hirschberg, 37, was convicted of predatory criminal sexual assault of a child in May by Judge Roger Weber in a bench trial in which attorneys on both sides agreed to the facts that Weber could consider. Those facts included that the child was 11 when she reported to Champaign County Sheriff's investigators that Hirschberger had molested her repeatedly between June 2013 and June 2016. Champaign County Sheriff's investigator Andrew Good interviewed Hirschberger on June 1, 2016, and Hirschberger admitted to the conduct. Assistant State's Attorney Scott Larson argued for a 30-year sentence, while defense attorney Jim Martinkus of Champaign sought 7 to 14 years, with a strong focus on rehabilitation. After hearing Larson read a letter written by the victim Monday, Weber said the defendant's action had serious effects for the victim, leading to him to the sentencing length. He was almost three times the age of her, Weber said. Hirschberger will have to serve 85% of the sentence and register as a sex offender. I would just like to tell the victim I'm truly, truly sorry for everything I've done, Hirschberger said through choked tears. I can't take back anything I've done, and I'm sorry for that. The charges against Hirschberger were filed on June 2, 2016. In October, Martinkus asked Weber to dismiss the Class X felony charges because of constitutional violations. Martinkus argued that the elements of the Class X charges were against his client were identical to the elements of the less serious Class II offense of aggravated criminal sexual assault and therefore violated the disproportionate penalty protections of the Eighth Amendment, which governs excessive punishment. The difference between the penalties for two crimes is significant. Predatory criminal sexual assault of a child carries a mandatory prison term of between 6 and 60 years. Aggravated sexual assault carries penalties ranging from probation to 3 to 7 years in prison. The state had argued that the offense elements were not truly identical because the predatory criminal sexual assault statute specifies contact with specific sex organs, whereas the aggravated criminal sexual abuse statute includes any body part touched. Weber agreed with the state. The court construes the predatory criminal sexual assault statute as providing enhanced penalties for very specific types of conduct that also constitute aggravated criminal sexual abuse. It does so in the same way that the burglary, residential burglary sentencing scheme provides for enhanced penalties when the burglary is of a very specific type of building, the dwelling place of another, he wrote. Both sentencing schemes, he noted, are within the prerogative of the legislature to set and do not violate the constitutional requirement that penalties be proportionate. By opting for Weber to hear the case, rather than having Hirschberg plead guilty, Martinkus was protecting Hirschberger's right to appeal the conviction and sentence on the disproportionate penalties grounds. Hirschberger does not have any prior felony convictions, but was charged with a DUI in 2002 and other various ordinance violations. I will continue with the article entitled Two More Deaths Investigated on Local News by Tom Kasich. Two other deaths at the Champaign County Nursing Home this year are under investigation, Champaign County Coroner Dwayne Northrup said Monday. On Saturday, the News Gazette reported that state public health officials had investigated a February 16th suicide at the facility, while the coroner and Illinois State Police are looking into the June 10th death of a memory care patient at the nursing home. Northrup said Monday, two other deaths are also being investigated by his office. We have four cases right now that we're looking into at the Champaign County Nursing Home, he said. We have cases as well at other nursing homes. I don't want to give the impression that this is only going on at Champaign County. We have deaths we're looking into at other facilities as well. Asked if it was unusual to have four deaths at one facility under investigation at the same time, he said, "Not necessarily. They're not all falls either. One of these cases is a suicide. That's more rare. They do happen, but we don't have a lot of suicides in nursing homes. Most of them are falls." At least one of the four deaths under investigation is from a fall. Another is a 78-year-old nursing home resident who was found dead June 10th in an outdoor courtyard at the facility. Her death and that of a fourth resident are considered undetermined, Northrup said. He declined to release any other details about the death investigations. "It could still be due to natural causes. We just have to wait for our results to come back," he said. "Two of the four may come back to be natural causes. I had to investigate them anyway because of the reported circumstances with what happened and how they were found. The result might be that they were natural causes, and then we'll only have two cases. And it's not uncommon for us to be looking into multiple cases at the same time. Unfortunately, because of the other public things that are going on at the Champaign County Nursing Home, these cases have more interest publicly than they normally would. Those other nursing home issues include financial problems, a plunging average daily census, and poor quality scores, particularly regarding food service. The Champaign County Board is to consider Thursday night hiring a new management company for the home to begin July 1st, plus securing another company to market the facility for its possible sale. I'll continue with the article entitled "Knife Point Holdup Cuts into Juveniles' Future Travel Plans" by Jim Day. Last October, a 13-year-old Urbana boy and one of his friends decided to rob a gas station at Knife Point. "Give us all your cigarettes," the malicious knuckleheads demanded. The station attendant was not intimidated by their threatening presence and refused to cooperate, so the pair grabbed six cigarette lighters from a counter display and ran off. Based on clothing descriptions provided by the station attendant, the pair was arrested by police shortly after the incident. Police recovered the lighters near the area where they arrested the two boys. Dustin W. tried to beat the rap. He argued that he was not guilty because his accomplice, another minor identified only as J.W., forced him to commit the armed robbery. Circuit Judge Heidi Ladd wasn't persuaded. She found Dustin W. to be a delinquent minor and sentenced him to 2 years of probation and told him, as one of conditions of probation, to stay away from the University of Illinois campus. Unhappy with the restriction, Dustin W. argued on appeal that Judge Ladd violated his constitutional right to travel by making the UI campus off-limits to him. Further, Dustin W.'s appellate lawyer argued the geographic restriction hinders Dustin W.'s rehabilitation. Universities are special places in our society where diversity of opinion is encouraged, where critical thinking is expected, and where children hope and aspire to attend. The University of Illinois, in particular, also encourages members of the general public to use its facilities. For example, the general public has access to the university's many libraries and can browse books and use the wireless internet available to all public visitors. Prohibiting Dustin W. from entering a college campus discourages aspirations for a higher education and may even cause Dustin W. to develop negative associations with institutes of higher education, the defense argued on appeal. A three-panel judge appeals court panel was not moved by the defense's objections to the alleged heartless nature of the order. It described the suggestion that Dustin W. was being denied access to a rich academic atmosphere as hyperbole of the first order. But the defense raised a legitimate issue. How far can trial courts go in fashioning conditions of probation? Further, under what circumstances can trial judges, for the reasons of public safety, make areas of a community off-limits to lawbreakers like Dustin W.? The court unanimously upheld that Judge Ladd's order was a narrowly tailored prohibition and satisfied the standard that such prohibitions not be overly broad. In barring Dustin W. from campus, Judge Ladd said he must not be present unless he is in the presence of his parent, guardian, or custodian, or unless provided advance permission by the probation officer. The three-judge appellate panel, Justices Thomas Appleton, Robert Steigman, and Thomas Harris, called the prohibition entirely reasonable and consistent with the goals of fostering rehabilitation and protecting the public. The university campus is the crown jewel of the Champaign-Urbana community, and efforts should be made by local law enforcement agencies, as well as local trial courts, to do all they can to ensure that the campus will be a sanctuary from crime, particularly violent crime, as in this case. The university is a world-class institution, attracting thousands of students and faculty from around the world. Efforts to provide extra protection for such persons is entirely understandable and commendable. Such efforts include barring 13-year-old armed robbers from the campus. Indeed, one would expect no less, Justice Stegman wrote for the court. Illinois's juvenile statutes specifically allow courts to bar offenders from going to certain places, but that power is not unlimited. Appeals courts have held that the court's distinction is limited by constitutional safeguards and must be exercised in a reasonable manner. For example, in 2003, a state's appeal court struck down a court order barring a 12-year-old South Elgin resident who was convicted of aggravated criminal sexual assault from living in or entering South Elgin while he was on probation. The court found the South Elgin prohibition was unconstitutionally overbroad because it failed to make the provision for the defendant to enter the area for legitimate purposes. In 2005, an appeals court struck down an order barring an adult sex offender from entering any school, park, or forest reserve at any time of day for any purposes. Once again, the appeals court found the court-imposed rule to be overly broad because it made no provision for legitimate access. In the case of Justin W., however, the appeals court found that he can visit the campus with appropriate supervision or the permission of his probation officer. So if, as his lawyer suggested, Justin W. is overwhelmed by the desire to expand his education in the UI's rarefied academic air, the court says he maintains the ability to do so. But if he and his buddies are looking to make more malicious mischief, the U.S. Constitution is okay with making the campus off-limits. I will continue with the article, For New Chief of Police, Step Up is Only Natural, by Natalie Wickman. Sylvia Morgan, whose hire as Urbana Police Chief became official Monday night, understands the meaning behind becoming the department's first female leader. But to the 24-year UPD veteran, the promotion felt natural. When we recruit women, we say the majority of your job is communicating and relating to people, Morgan said, and don't be intimidated by law enforcement being a male-dominated field. Morgan, who earned her bachelor's degree in criminology from Wichita State and attended FBI National University, has worked in almost every job an Urbana officer can have. That includes chief. She has run the department on an interim basis since Pat Connolly resigned in April to spend more time with family. I don't have any big changes planned. Maybe different ways of doing things, Morgan said after Urbana City Council members approved her new position late Monday. Continually working on community relationships is a big thing. The council also voted Monday night to approve the $46 million fiscal budget, which Mayor Diane Marlin hopes will take Urbana on a path out of financial uncertainty once it takes effect on July 1st. The budget was okayed by every council member but one, Aaron Ammons, after receiving no comment from residents during a public previous hearing. Ammons also voted against the budget during a preliminary vote last week, citing the 1.5% increase in the food and beverage tax, and the $9,588 hike in funding to the Champaign County Economic Development Corporation as his reasons for casting a no. In response, Marlin had Craig Ross, the EDC's executive director, make a presentation to the council at Monday's meeting. Ross said, increased EDC financial support will lead to regional stability for the county. He said regionally focused business development is key to survival in downstate Illinois, especially with a state budget impasse. You don't hear about Austin, Texas. You hear about Austin, Rost said. We have to market ourselves as a destination, where people want to go and succeed if they can, do it for half the price of Silicon Valley. In 2016, the EDC advised 299 clients, 212 of them new, 69 women, and 96 minorities. It's a nonprofit with funding sources that are two-thirds public and one-third private, Rost said. Ammon said he doesn't think the extra EDC funding will be enough to bring significant improvements. What we're ultimately saying is Urbana is going to somehow become the hub of business activity because of this money, Ammon said. While I support economic development, we have a city department for it. Among the other items in the new budget, there was also a last-minute budget amendment proposed by Alderman Dean Hazen to increase the Urbana Business Association's general fund from $14,000 to $21,000. It was approved with only two aldermen opposing. The UBA also receives money from TIF funds. The new budget reflects the city's shift in mayoral leadership from Laurel Pressing to Marlin this spring. Marlin decided to reinstate the city administration position, which Pressing cut to hire a mayoral chief of staff. Once an administrator is hired from a nationwide search, that person will handle day-to-day city tasks and coordinate among departments. We have to have professional management, restoring some of the policies and updating practices that really haven't been addressed in years, Marlin said. The city administrator will cost about $190,000 annually, with an additional $28,000 in one-time first-year expenses. The mayor's chief of staff earned $110,000 annually. Marlin also decided to remove $5.26 million from the city's general operating fund in case Urbana loses its court battle over Carle Foundation Hospital's property taxes. The state Supreme Court decided in March to send the long-standing case back to a circuit court. It is not ours to spend at this time and should not be presented as such, Marlin said about the $5.26 million in a budget memo. Raising the food and beverage tax, which only applies to prepared food for immediate consumption and alcoholic beverages, is expected to generate $390,000 for the cities annually. There will also be a voluntary separation incentives program, with cash incentives based on years of service for non-union city employees. There will be modest wage increases for union and some non-union employees, but not for department and division heads, management staff, or most professional employees. After a 4.5 increase in assessed value, property tax revenues will increase to $4.29 million. Of that, $2 million is budgeted for police and fire pension funds, and $2.3 million is for city services. I will continue with an article entitled "His Vision Began at a Young Age, and It Resulted in a State Title" by Anthony Zylis. The photo of Nicholas Jackson hurling over a bar at some unknown height as a sophomore of Jean Armour track on the campus of Urbana High School has faded into the background of Champaign Central's senior four bulletin boards in his room. But at one point, it served as a crucial roadmap for his high-jumping career. "Jackson clears 6'8", he had typed over the photo, as if he was writing a headline 2 years premature, when his personal best was just 6'3". The medals and ribbons he piled up throughout his career crowded around the photo but never completely obscured it. And after returning from a meet at Jean Armour Track earlier this season, his eyes locked on the photo he had nearly forgotten. He grabbed his parents and showed them the image. "That's when all of the hair stood up on the backs of our necks," said Mark Jackson, Nicholas's father. The prophecy had come true. After years of improvement, Jackson had cleared 6'8" that night at that same track. 3 months later, at the Class 2A State Track and Field Meet, Jackson stood facing the bar, set at 6'9", rocking forward and back, envisioning all the 10 run-up steps in his head, before seeing himself arch over the bar perfectly for a clearance that would likely win state after his opponent, Seth Groom from Marmion, missed his opening attempt. "I'm thinking, if I make this, I bet I win," he said. When it came time for his jump, he leapt up in the air and arched his back in a far different pose than that one in the photo at Urbana 2 years earlier. He kicked his legs as he flew over the bar, somersaulting on the mat. He cleared it. Then he waited, turning his back towards the bar and facing his parents on the other side of the chain-link fence at Eastern Illinois' O'Brien Stadium. Groom missed his final attempt, sending Jackson running back toward the high jump pit in a euphoric frenzy, shouting, "State champ! Let's go!" Once again, a prophecy came true. Jackson won the state title he dreamt of for years. As a result, he is the News Gazette's 2017 Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year, and throughout his 7-year journey to 6'9", visualization has remained a key to his success. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for June 20th, 2017. Please stay tuned.